tonight on Arena, we'll be reviewing new TV, including The Night Manager and Runaway, and finding out what you should be looking forward to in music in 2026. You are, as usual, very welcome along to Friday Night's Arena. Text us on 51551, our WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena at rte.ie, and our Instagram is at rte_arena. As usual, three TV shows up for discussion tonight to get us going. First up, The Night Manager, starring Tom Hiddleston. It returns to BBC One and Prime with a sequel to the original smash hit series based on a John le Carré novel. Next, James Nesbitt and Minnie Driver star in writer Harlan Coben's Runaway. It's a new series on Netflix with twin plot lines about missing adult children. Nesbitt and Minnie Driver are parents to three children, one of whom, Paige, they rarely see anymore because of a drug habit and a nasty boyfriend. And finally, Canadian ice hockey drama and internet sensation Heated Rivalry comes to Sky. Wait till we get to that one. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have been watching all three for us. They're with me now in studio. Welcome to you both. Jen, let's start with Night Manager Season 2, because it's been a very long time in coming. So maybe just remind us who Tom Hiddleston's Jonathan Pine is, and of Season 1, what happened there.
It's been a while. It's been almost a decade, and I had completely forgotten most of what happened in the first season of The Night Manager. I do remember it was this very flashy John le Carré thriller where you had Tom Hiddleston. He seemed to be at that time, I think, auditioning to be the new James Bond as the spy, Jonathan Pine, who was this classic, professionally blank English gent, and he was making his way in Egypt. He worked in a grand hotel at the epicenter of the Arab Spring, and he ended up eventually joining forces with Elizabeth Debicki's spy Samira against Hugh Laurie's character, Roper, who was this 24-karat gold baddie. He was a proper good, you could get really into watching Hugh Laurie chew the scenery up in Season 1. I think that and Olivia Colman, and actually Tom Hollander, arena favourite Tom Hollander, made it. I think those three performances were so good, it kind of carried you through it, because in and around that, it was just very beautifully shot. It had this pacey script that kept you gripped, but it also had what we don't talk about a lot in TV these days, is that air of confidence that you don't get in these terrestrial dramas anymore. It was a pleasing throwback, I would say, to a different time that I think a lot of viewers appreciated. But can they repeat the same trick again? And the thing about this time around is we're in a very different televisual landscape to where we were when it was like 10 years ago. 10 years ago, The Night Manager felt bombastic. It felt like something that was different to, say, the grit of, say, something like Homeland or The Americans, other espionage dramas that were happening at the time. This time around, it is a crowded landscape that we have going for us.
Okay, Chris, I'm glad that Jen has explained that to us, because you and I both missed Series 1. So tell me what's happening in Series 2, because it does seem as if they're doing their very best to make sure that the likes of you and I can just jump straight in.
Yeah, I don't really know where I was, because this thing was a critical and commercial smash, and it was quite successful at the Primetime Emmy Awards, the Golden Globes, but I missed the whole thing. But thankfully, there's a detailed and coherent, previously on The Night Manager in episode one. And I think the reason, and also the writing throughout the first couple of episodes, is so accessible for newcomers. I think the reason for that is because it has been 10 years. It's been 10 years in real life, and it's been 10 years in the story. And it would be maybe a bit too cocky and probably, you know, a bit too ambitious to kind of just presume that audiences will come back after 10 years. So they have made room for newcomers. It is quite easy to follow. It's another mission for Jonathan Pine, but he's not Jonathan Pine anymore. He's Alex Goodwin. That's Tom Hiddleston's character. And we see him at the very beginning, first 4 years after the original series, identifying the corpse of Roper. That's Hugh Laurie's character, the arms dealer from the first time around. He is dead. Olivia Colman is back for a few minutes to identify the body. Crucially, not Tom Hiddleston's character, but I'm sure we'll come back to that later on in the series. And then 6 years afterwards, so there is a 10-year jump. the same as in real life. And Alex Goodwin is now, you know, he's still working for Riverhouse. He's still working for the Secret Intelligence Service. He is the head of a surveillance unit called the Night Elves. And it's their job to sit back and survey, sit back and observe. And, you know, they can't get involved in stopping criminal activities, but they report to, you know, the higher up chiefs. Is this a good job for Goodwin? Yes and no. This is a man who has some serious trauma. You know, the what happened to him in season one has clearly had some sort of awful effect on him, but he's going to therapy. He's not really talking about it though. He might also be a little bit bored. Maybe he misses being on the ground. And long story short, when a ghost from his past, a ghost who was an affiliate of Roper's from the first season, shows up in one of the hotels that the Night Elves are looking at, he can't help but chase that ghost. It brings them to Spain and everything goes wrong for himself and his team.
Yeah, it is telegraphed very heavily, very early on, that Tom Hiddleston is a man who lives with quite a lot of trauma. So let's have a listen to this. He's in a session with a corporate therapist admitting pretty much nothing.
This is the MI6 quarterly evaluation for Alex Goodwin, director of the Night Owls unit. Shall we begin?
Sure.
So, Alex, is there anything keeping you awake at night?
No. No.
And how's your family?
Family's great, yeah.
And romantically, any developments on that front?
Yep. Actually, I've started going out with my neighbour. Mm-hmm.
I see you've requested to stay with the Night Owls for another 3 years.
Yes, yep.
How do you feel about that?
I feel good. I love working for Rex Mayhew. I love my team.
Jen, the Night Owls, they give Tom Hiddleston a kind of posse, not a slow horses posse, but in that kind of mould. What's going on there?
See, this is it. We're mentioning slow horses already. Mm-hmm. And it's like the spectre of slow horses is all over this, unfortunately, in a way, because this season is not a John le Carré. It's not a John le Carré. We're not adapting anything. It's a brand new story. So it has to be very tightly done. It has to be, you know, cooked up properly. And that may be an issue for people because he does have this, yeah, almost slow horses posse. You have an assistant, Sally, who's played by Hayley Squires, and she almost acts like his conscience a lot during it. She's a bit like Jiminy Cricket. She follows him to, someone has to look after this man. He's kind of walking through the world like he's in a waking nightmare. So she follows him to Spain to basically look after him because he gets involved. He's on this kind of quest for justice, or is it vengeance? Like, that becomes clear after, you know, quickly into the first episode. So a man calling himself the true disciple of Richard Roper is running guns in Colombia, and nobody at MI6 seems as concerned as Pine. And you have Indira Varma, she's playing this very suspicious chief, and then Paul Chahidi is this skittish handler as well in MI6, and they don't seem to want Pine involved in this at all for whatever reasons, but that's not going to stop him. And that's when Sally kind of follows him from the Night Owls into this level of work, and she wants to keep him alive and to give him a shake when necessary. And I think she is the foil that someone like Tom Hiddleston's character needs, because he is a bit of a ghost himself. Mm. Like, you see him at those therapy sections. And I do feel with the show, because it's not based on le Carré anymore and it's an original idea, that a lot of it rests on Hiddleston's shoulders. Now, previously, you did have big power players like Hugh Laurie, like Olivia Colman, like Tom Hollander, that could carry that, share the weight a bit about. But this is all Hiddleston all the time. And that can be an issue because, apart from that very British internal way he has, there's not enough there, I think. Even, you know, he is tormented, but you don't see it enough. He can kind of be extra blank in a way. Yeah. And I think that is not the greatest central character you can have. He's very smooth and charismatic, but maybe not as charismatic as he could be.
Yeah, it can also depend on how much you love Tom Hiddleston, Tom Hiddleston all the time. I want to play this. This is from the moment relatively early on where he has spotted the familiar face in surveillance on a poker night, and he asks his colleague Rex Mayhew, who is played by Douglas Hodge, about him. Rex is the only person who knows him from his life before. Let's have a listen.
I got your message. Show me what you've got. Taken last night. Old Roper field man. What's he doing coming to London under a false name?
You sure it's him?
Absolutely sure.
You talk to anyone else about this?
How could I? I'm Alex Goodwin now.
And you should stay that way.
Rex, I'd like to talk to Burr.
Absolutely not. Angela's retired, fully detached. She barely leaves her French retreat and won't want to be disturbed over some soldier for hire.
Chris, it has been 10 years since the first series, so obviously a programme like this needs to up its production values, its budget, its round-the-worldness. Does it look good?
A little bit, yeah, but there's a sense, like, I was thinking of The Leftovers today. Very different show, but you had a very successful show that was based on one book, and when it was successful, the people behind us were, you know, being asked to do a second season. They thought, if we do that, there's no blueprint, we have to make stuff up. And for that second and third season, they just went big on ideas and big on the look of it. This one, it feels as though everyone is maybe just a little bit unsure, how do we follow up Le Carré without Le Carré? So in terms of, you know, the style, in terms of the storytelling, in terms of the performances, everything just maybe feels, just based on the little bits that I've seen from the first season, I realise I'm missing out and I will go back to it at some point, it feels just a little bit smaller. So if the first season was, you know, all, you know, an ensemble piece, but as Jen says, you know, an audition in a way for Tom Hiddleston to be Bond, this feels like it's like, okay, let's give Tom Hiddleston another audition for Bond, and there's a bit too much of him, and I think it overestimates at times like our interest in watching Tom Hiddleston walk around, you know, hotel corridors all day, or, you know, strut about town not being recognised despite the fact that all he does is wear a cap. I don't know how he's not recognised.
He combs his hair in a different way
all the time. That annoyed me. He had a different hair. He has about four different hairstyles in the first 10 minutes of this show. What I did like about it, though, is that it gives Diego Calva, who was we haven't seen much of after his appearance in Babylon a few years ago, it gives him the chance to play, you know, a good old fashioned slippery baddie, and he is quite good at it. That is the thing that won me over about this. It does feel refreshing old fashioned. You've got like corrupt MI6 officials, a reluctant goody spy, you've got a flashy criminal who talks too much, and you've got a mystery player played by Camilla Morone, who assists both sides, and that gets her into an awful lot of trouble. That sort of setup will never go out of fashion. So there's nothing here that we haven't seen before, but I wasn't bored.
Is one of the problems about this, Jen, that weight of expectation, because the first series was so popular and so loved, and it has been a long time
for
series two to turn up?
And like I said, so much is there right now to compete for our attention. Like The White Lotus has the exotic location sewn up, and it also has the social commentary done as well. But then you also have, like we said, Slow Horses. You cannot deny that that has been something that has, you know, breathed fresh air just into the spy genre by making it more accessible, by making it funny, by making it surreal, by like giving its characters that depth that I think Tom Hiddleston's character just doesn't have at the moment. He feels like, I know within this there will be these twists, there will be these massive reveals, but I think right now it's missing that paranoia, that unnerving feeling that all good thrillers should have. And I hope they need to up the ante a bit and start that startling bit of television that, you know, is going to happen, but it might be too little too late for some people, because as I said, it's so different now. 10 years, we're not willing to stick with things. If it doesn't, you know, engross you straight away, you're going to move on to the next thing. So I think they might be missing a trick in that way. But I do feel for David Farr, the writer, it's a huge thing to tackle, to make, you know, a Le Carré in a way your own, to try and do Le Carré. And that's a big responsibility. And it's going okay so far. It's chugging along, and it's hitting all those right beats, as you said. Maybe it's an audition for Camilla Morone to be a Bond girl in another way.
Like,
yeah. So maybe she's the one that's pushing, like, going to be the breakout star in some way to this, but I'm not satisfied is the point I think I'm trying to make here.
Okay, give me some stars.
2.5. I would like to see a pop-up of some old friends from season one, which I don't think is going to happen.
Okay, Chris?
I might go 3.5. I think it's going to get better. I'm not sure if I just hope it's going to get better.
It's an aspirational 3.5.
Yeah, okay. But I think there's something worth sticking with there. Yeah, so I will.
Okay, that's The Night Manager. Another new month, another new Harlan Coben TV series. This time it is Run Away, a thriller starring James Nesbitt, Minnie Driver and Ruth Jones. It follows Simon Green, played by James Nesbitt, who's a father desperately searching for his missing daughter, Paige. Chris, fill us in on the rest of where we start here.
How long have we got?
We've done it many times.
So there's about 3 or 4 different things going on in the first episode. Yeah, you're right. Look, I suppose the central tale is that of Simon Green, played by James Nesbitt. And we begin with him appearing to find his missing daughter, Paige, played by Ellie DeLange. She's busking in a local park. We learn that she's been missing for 6 months, that she ran off one day with a troublemaker boyfriend, both of them having developed a debilitating drug habit together. And basically, Dad's been looking for her for all that time. Mum Ingrid hasn't, though. Mum Ingrid, played by Minnie Driver. She believes that their daughter basically has to find her way back, or she has to get to rock bottom for them, you know, to then finally help her. But Simon has obviously been paying a lot of people to kind of tip him off in terms of where she's going to be. Does Paige want to come home? She doesn't. The boyfriend intervenes, and Simon basically beats this boyfriend to a bloody pulp. And it's a big deal because someone records him beating the umphla, and that goes viral. That's, you know, it's not ideal for a number of reasons, but most of all because a couple of days later, that boyfriend is discovered dead in his flat. So bear with me here. This is a time then when Simon and Ingrid decide, okay, we're going to investigate alongside the detectives. They're going to try and figure out who killed the boyfriend. We're going to use this time while nobody's watching us to try and find out where Paige is. That's one story. Another story then follows Ruth Jones, Elena Ravenscroft. That should have been the name of the show. She is a private investigator investigating someone else's missing son. But that case, and also a case she's investigating in a vegan restaurant, might be connected to Paige. And then finally, I say finally, but this is just one of half a dozen others.
You're just skimming it here, really.
There's another involving John Poynting, who we both love. From Big Boys. And himself and a partner spend their nights driving around whatever part of the UK this is set in, assassinating people. And they are like something from a pound shop version of Pulp Fiction. They sit outside someone's house, they talk about things that make no sense, and then he goes inside and shoots someone and is told to make it look different. How do all of these stories connect? I don't know, but hopefully it's going somewhere.
Pound Shop Pulp Fiction is also a show I'd watch.
I would, but yeah.
I want to take a clip. This is from relatively early on, and it is James Nesbitt playing Simon Green. It is just after the altercation in the park. He meets his new lawyer, Tracy Ann Oberman, as Jessica Kimberg, and it's the aftermath of him punching his daughter Paige's nasty boyfriend, Aaron, and then being filmed.
Jessica Kimberg, Yvonne sent me to get you out of here.
Simon Green.
So the scumbag was your wayward daughter's boyfriend, right? And you punched him in the face.
Right.
Wrong. You are the victim. All your actions entirely self-defense. Problem is, it doesn't look like self-defense in this video.
Oh, shit.
This is out of context. It doesn't show the start.
Seeing is believing, Simon. Online, and all people are seeing is you, smart guy in a suit, hitting a homeless man.
That's not what happened.
And look at the views.
Oh, my God.
You got unlucky. Some YouTuber in the park doing a class caught everything on camera, uploaded it, and is now ranting to all their followers online. Don't look at the comments.
OK, so, Jen, this is a nice, easy, straight-down-the-line story that is not going to confuse any of us.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, look, the thing about these Harlan Coben dramas is they've become this kind of punchline to the new year. There's TikTok parodies of just how rickety they are. But there's no getting away from the fact that they're extremely popular. And Danny Brocklehurst is helming this one again. And he's done a couple of these.
Lazarus the last one we talked about?
Yeah, I think. And he's done Brassic. He's written for Shameless. He's turned his hand to try and wrestle this into something cohesive. He's cultivating this very specific formula, but I feel for the man. I get upset when I think about him with a whiteboard going slowly insane, trying to connect these dots. Because what works for Harlan Coben as a page turner, which is fine to throw in as many red herrings as he can, and this is what these characters are. They're multiple red herrings, and then you narrow it down and narrow it down. But he keeps on inflating. He keeps on getting bigger instead of the story getting smaller. He keeps on getting bigger and bigger. And that doesn't work for TV. It can work for fiction, for books, when you're, you know, flying through a book, but not when it's supposed to be 8 episodes. And there's way too much going on here. And I also feel like it could be split into 3-4 different shows. I mean, we've seen James Nesbitt do the whole harrowing father upset about, you know, their child going missing, the worst thing that could happen to a parent in The Missing, which he was great and terrific in. You can't repeat this same trick here when the material isn't as good. But that is one storyline. Then you have the detectives, which is another storyline, which I honestly felt like this could be its own sitcom. The investigation is headed up by Detective Fagbenle, played by Alfred Enoch. And he asks the most basic questions and the most does the most bizarre things. Like at one point, he lets Simon go into the hospital room of one of the drug dealers that may or may not have shot his wife. I mean, it's strange also that a policeman would afford a drug dealer more sympathy than a parent that is missing a child, which he does with Simon, the distraught father. And he's growing so suspicious of Simon in this very cartoonish and cliched manner. It's just, you have James Nesbitt, who is teetering on the edge of sanity. Then you have his performance, which is a lot of smarm, a lot of glaring into the camera. It's a heavy ham sandwich with a lot of mayo that you'd have to tackle. And he's supposed to be the savvy cop with an attitude, but instead it's about like him and his partner in more ways than one. DC mm-hmm. Ruby Todd, played by the comedian Amy Gledhill. They're like they're in a completely different show. It feels farcical. It ups that ante where this show feels very surreal. And I actually think their scenes would work better as a comedy when they're together about bumbling detectives who think they know it all, but they're actually extremely incompetent. Let's do this spin-off instead. And then you have Elena Ravenscroft, the Ruth Jones character. That feels like a cozy crime drama about a missing girl that could be a total other show. And then you have the Natural Born Killer style John Poynting storyline. None of these things, like, they do match up eventually, but in the most incredibly crazy way that is supposed to keep you gripped, but for me just made me more and more angry. And I think that's the point. I think it's not a Harlan Coben drama on Netflix if you're not shouting a load of expletives when the credits are rolling at the end of the whole thing and feel like you've wasted your life a bit.
I am very tempted to ask for star ratings for each of the three individual stories, but give me one for overall.
Overall, I mean, it's two. I just want a slower pace. I want something well-structured and thought out, and Runaway, at best, it just feels like somebody throwing darts at various styles, various genres, various storylines, and hoping for a good result. John Poynting deserves better, as always.
Yeah.
Chris, thoughts?
I think it's all enough to make you feel dizzy, and I certainly did. Forget tone, forget quality, forget prestige television, because this is not that. I think it's board game telly at its silliest, and unlike previous Harlan Coben shows that have unfortunately taken themselves far too seriously, I get the feeling that everyone is in on the joke here. I certainly hope they are. So I kind of accepted it almost like a comedy and something that is designed to be shouted at and played along with, and, you know, fun to guess who's having an affair with who, who's going to double cross who next, who's going to die next, who's going to wake up from that death next. I actually started to have fun with this. So that's not something I've experienced with Harlan Coben before. I'm going to give it 2 stars and then an extra star for James Nesbitt's imaginative swearing in this, because it is something else.
Finally, for this week, Heated Rivalry. It's a Canadian series about professional ice hockey with a secret gay romance at its centre. Fast becoming a global sensation, previously unknown cast are being beamed to stardom, and Rachel Reid's novels are now getting a bounce onto the bestseller list. Jen, the story of how this has become a sensation is a great story in and of itself.
I love this. What I love about Heated Rivalry is that it is an old school sensation. We haven't had a show in such a long time that's captured the imagination of viewers in this seemingly very organic way. It was a small Canadian show that started off life on the Canadian network Crave, which came to the attention of HBO, and it was dropped on HBO at the end of November without any fanfare, without any hype, probably because they thought it would be this very niche concern. It's not a starry cast. It's a queer love story. The backdrop is hockey. But now it has taken over the cultural conversation. And as you said, the two stars, Connor Story and Hudson Williams, are becoming they're these overnight sensations. And they will be sitting with Charlie XCX and Paul Mescal at the Golden Globes on Sunday. I like that these things can still happen unexpectedly without the temperature being taken, the zeitgeist temperature being taken, without it being a perfectly drilled PR package. And I'm all for that. I'm all for a big audience discovering this and being invested in it. They're not being pushed to watch this by a certain algorithm or a savvy marketing campaign. People found this and it was word of mouth. And that, it can still happen. And I'm so glad that that can still be something on TV.
What happens here then when we begin?
Yeah, I mean, the plot is actually refreshingly simple. How many times have we sat here so confused? But this is really straightforward. It's inspired by a series of novels by Rachel Reid, and it tells of two professional athletes, Shane Hollander, played by Hudson Williams, and Ilya Rozanov, Connor Story, both of whom are, in 2008, the next big things in ice hockey. Shane is a Japanese-Canadian player who will go on to eventually captain the Montreal Metros, and he's the quiet, humble type, the guy who, you know, he's got this manager mom who has his whole brand and his legacy for all figured out, but he just wants to play ice hockey. He just wants to be the best that he can be. Whereas Ilya, on the other hand, is this mouthy superstar in the making. You know, he's overly confident. He's obnoxious. He believes his own hype. He's originally from Moscow, and he has to be, you know, if he, you know, it has to be a win. If he loses his match, his dad's on the phone shouting at him. His brother at home is constantly asking for money back. So these guys are at opposite ends of their field. And they're also being pushed by the media. There's this competition between them, whether it's at press conferences or at award ceremonies or even on the rink, to, you know, this competition between them is almost created by everyone around them. What nobody knows is that behind closed doors, they are actually, you know, they're sleeping together. And the two of them develop this romance over a year, because I think it takes place over eight to ten years.
Yeah.
So we check in 3 months and 6 months later, and then 4 weeks, like, it's constantly jumping around the place. But we see their love affair develop, but always behind closed doors. And sometimes the romance, the love between them, is quite nice, it's quite tender, the two of them are on the same page. A lot of the time, unfortunately, though, it can be toxic. You know, Ilya is just completely, you know, he's unpredictable. You don't know whether he's going to be hot or cold with Shane, and that sort of naturally starts to build a bit of a resentment between them. And they're also afraid to come out, because, again, this is, you know, it's less than 20 years ago, but it's at a time where they both believe that if they come out, especially in this very macho sport, it will be the end of their careers, and it could really impact their lives as well.
Okay, this is From It. This is one night after the Boston Raiders have lost a game. A defeated Ilya calls around Shane's apartment. Ilya is played by Connor Story, and Shane is played by Hudson Williams.
You will murder me.
Maybe. Get in. Why the f*** did you think it was okay to sex me before the game? What the f***?
You were hurt, weren't you? For how long? All game?
So f***ing ass.
Well, you missed me, didn't you?
I f***ing did it. And I still beat your ass.
Barely. Wow, nice place.
Thanks. I bought it a couple years ago, but then this year I bought another one right next door. I eventually might turn it into one place, but for now, I'm renting the next door one out.
Mr. Businessman.
Shut up.
Mr. Landlord.
You asked.
No, I didn't.
Jen, what did you make of it?
I think, like, there has been so much conversation around here, this show in particular, that it's sometimes hard. You have to kind of parse a lot of talk, a lot of discourse away from the show itself. And I know there is this talk about the show because who is the audience for Heated Rivalry? Because the book was written by a woman, and romance books of this ilk are aimed squarely at a female readership, and how the authenticity of queer life maybe in those books can be molded into heteronormative tropes. And that's always a worry. But I can understand that criticism. It happens a lot when you see queer dramas, when you see shows like Heartstopper or a film like Love, Simon. They're made for a teen audience, and they're more about the first bloom of love rather than more complicated lives of grown adults. Even in film and TV right now, queer people still fall into the cliche of the funny, goofy, bitchy best friend, the sidekick. Their interior life is never explored, and it's done in this fairly neutral, non-sexual way, so as not to scare advertisers or scare a bigger audience away, I guess. And I think the success of Heated Rivalry may show that this doesn't have to always be the case. Yes, there are plenty of sex scenes. Yes, the sex scenes are very graphic, but there's also graphic sex scenes in normal people, in industry, in most adult TV. And the story is about an illicit relationship, so that is going to feature. And I think the fact that it's been adapted to the screen by a writer-director, Jacob Tierney, who is a gay man, that's what makes the difference to it. That's what makes it a more compelling and authentic watch. And I think that's why it's finding its queer audience, and they are saying, this is actually something that we do want to watch. Yes, it might be Hallmark-esque in the way it's pretty generic. Sometimes when I was watching it, I was like, is this just a sexy, you know, One Tree Hill? But then you get to an episode like episode 3, which I think totally changes the texture of the show, which is about another, it's an exploration of another hockey player, Scott Hunter. He's this New York hockey veteran, and you think he is entering into a relationship with this barista called Kip, and you think he's going to cause trouble for the heroes in the story, first of all, because he picks up a vibe between the two of them, but it's about him holding on to his own secret. And it's a gorgeous, heartbreaking look at the corrosive nature of not being your authentic self and how masculinity can be a trap still for so many men out there, even today.
Okay. Chris, we've kind of run out of time on this, but give me a few lines on this, your thoughts, and then give me some stars.
I think an awful lot has been made about the sex scenes in this show. I didn't find the sex scene, there is a lot of sex in this, but I didn't find it overly explicit. And I actually agree with the show creator, Jacob Tierney, when he says that they're there to serve the story, to understand why, Shane and Ilya are drawn to one another and why they have this connection. We need to see what they're like when they're left to themselves and when they are literally stripped of that shame that they feel when they're around their teammates. And I thought those scenes were actually quite beautiful and tender and really well managed. It's when you move outside of the bedroom, outside of the apartment that we heard them there in that clip, the dramatic tension just fizzles out. And some of the writing and some of the dialogue, it is quite abysmal in places, which is so disappointing because there's two very strong leads here. There's a showrunner who knows what he's doing. I would have said as well, it's all well and good to have, you know, these characters well-formed, which they are, but the world around them sometimes wasn't. And I realise this is a bit of a comical complaint, but I don't know that much about ice hockey. And in order to create a world that feels lived in and authentic and one where, you know, like, educate the viewer, like, tell them more about this world, make it feel as though it's, you know, it's more lived in. So there is something here, but Hallmark is actually, that's a good description. It does feel a little bit too like that at the minute.
But it does owe a lot to Luca Guadagnino's Challengers as well, I will say, with the propulsive, like, the techno kind of sound and soundtrack at the start of it and those fast cuts. So I do enjoy the fact that he's trying to do something with it and elevate it a bit. Not as successful as you would think, but I will say it is a big moment as well, because if the stars of the show are getting DMs from actual sports stars saying they're still in the closet, they don't know what to do, they feel totally trapped by the lives that they're living, it's doing something. And I think it's an important conversation moment to have, and I'm glad that TV can still do that.
Okay, stars, Chris.
I think, yeah, good luck to it. And also, I would like to see more from two stars in the future, and I think we will be, but I didn't think much of the drama, as I say, so it's 2.5 out of 5.
Jen?
Solid 3. I don't know if it'll be a real game changer, but I'm glad it is getting the attention that it is getting right now.
Okay, Chris Wasser, Jen Gannon, thanks for joining us. And you are listening to Friday Night's Arena. If you're looking for reasons to be cheerful at this time of the year, and who isn't, what about a look at some of the musical delights in store for us in 2026? What album releases should we be keeping an eye on? What gigs should we be booking tickets for? Are there festivals that are worth the mud and the rain? The answer is no, of course, but we'll figure out what the guys say. John Maher and Zara Hederman are here with their picks of what will be orally exciting you this year. Evening to both of you. Are you both full of anticipation for 2026, John?
Oh, yeah. There's so many exciting things. I mean, the Gorillaz album, for instance, and also they're playing the Three Arena. They're also going to be on the festival circuit here. Damon Albarn and his cartoon friends will be spending a lot of time in Ireland, but I always think it's a cause for celebration. And you know, people like Charlie XCX as well, albeit with a film soundtrack, Wuthering Heights. I can't forget My School Days, one of my favourite books, and still. But to hear what she does with that source material, yeah, a lot to be excited by.
Okay, Zara?
I'm bursting at the seams with excitement. I can't wait. Especially because I'm on the edge of my seat as to whether Lana Del Rey is actually going to release her album this time. She promised us 2 more singles by the end of last year. They did not arrive. Metacritic doesn't even have the album.
She's
under
doing
the January
a Kanye
30th
on
date.
This, isn't she, in a
she
way?
Is.
She's getting a bit too kind of perfectionist in her.
She's keeping us on her toes, yeah. Which I do respect. I do respect
well,
that.
Let's start with the Lana Del Rey album, because you both chose it as part of your selections. Zara, tell us about this whole will she, won't she, is it, isn't it?
So it's already missed 2 release dates. It has had 2 album name changes. It was originally Lasso, then The Right Person Will Stay. It's now called Stove. And this album actually goes back to 2021 when she went back and listened to her singles Ride and Love Video Games. She heard a kind of a Americana sensibility to it. And she was then like, maybe I'll do a country album. So she talked to Jack Antonoff. She recorded a covers country album. And since then, she has been doing performances of like Stand By Your Man, Take Me Home, Country Roads. Now, she has said that part of the delay was because she wanted to add 6 autobiographical songs to the album. So within that, we had singles Henry, Come On and Bluebird. And listening to them, they have a really like really beautiful kind of culty lilt to them. So by those indications, I am really excited by this.
All right, we're going to take a little bit from Bluebird. This is Lana Del Rey.
Wide open, we both shouldn't be dealing with him. Find a way to fly.
And that's Lana Del Rey, Bluebird, from the album that may or may not be named Stove, and that may or may not be coming out over the next couple of months. You wanted to talk about Charlie XCX then, John.
Yeah, I absolutely.
It was almost like you were on pause there for a moment. No, I know it's an exciting moment.
It is an exciting moment. Well, it's kind of a film moment as well, because Emerald Fennell has famously from Saltburn reputation has made an adaptation, a film adaptation of Wuthering Heights, and it's starring Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi. Interesting casting, it has to be said. And Charlie XCX has been charged with penning original songs for it. I suppose music history knows that Kate Bush arrived as a 16 or 17 year old with the most extraordinary single, inspired by that amazing Bronte book. Appropriately enough for a great love story, it's coming out Valentine's weekend. I'm really looking forward to what Charlie XCX does, but I'm also very much looking forward to, I think, a great director and what she does with it, with the source material.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the trailer, I think you probably should, although possibly not with little people in the room.
Well, yes.
Let's have a listen to this. This is from the Wuthering Heights soundtrack. This is Charlie XCX doing Chains of Love. It's Charlie XCX, Chains of Love, and it comes from the Wuthering Heights album. The album is coming out at the same time as the film, as far as I know. So the weekend of February.
Weekend
13th.
Of Valentine's.
Okay. Seamus Fogarty, Ship. Sarah, talk to me about that.
Yeah, really interesting artist. I remember seeing him live in Workman's maybe like 5 years ago and was immediately captivated by him. He's a Mayo-born, London-based artist who does like this really cool melding of electronica with acoustic guitar picked like folk music. He has cited the likes of, say, Smog, Palace Brothers, John Fahey and O'Tekra as like some of his influences. Cillian Murphy is a massive fan, and actually one of the songs that Cillian Murphy in particular loves, they recognised him, is going to feature on this album. So Seamus Fogarty has described the lyrics of this as exploring everything from humorous slice of life vignettes touching on love loss, DIY coffins, cans on trains with strangers, and so much more. So that's kind of like the everyday ubiquity that we get in his lyricism. He reminds me sometimes of like a junior brother, a Paddy Hannah is well sometimes, but at the same time he's completely singular and just really brilliant.
Okay, let's have a listen to this. The album's coming out in March. It's called Ship, and this is Fire. Seamus Fogarty, that's a song called Fire. The album is Ship. It's out in March. John, you wanted to talk about a couple of Irish artists.
Yeah, at the last Friday this month, Alva Reddy's third album, Big Kiss, comes out. She's somebody I've always admired. I think you've had her on the show very recently. I would love to feel that this is the album that could push her to the next level. And also another Irish act absolutely worth anybody's attention is Scratch. Wonderful title. Their new album is called Pull Like a Dog. It's been produced by John Spud Murphy, considered by many to be the unofficial fifth member of Lancome. From what I've heard of it so far, it's a cracking album.
Okay, I want to play some Alva Reddy. If you were listening to Monday night's programme, you would have heard her. She was in studio with us playing acoustically. But we talked about it at the time. The album is quite different. So this is That Girl, Alva Reddy. Yeah, very different to what she played acoustically for us earlier in the week. You can listen back to that session. You'll find it where you find your podcasts, or on Monday Night's Arena in the RTE radio player. That's Alva Reddy, That Girl. We are going to take a quick break and we'll come back from that looking at some of the gigs to look forward to in 2026. Hey. It's Friday nights. Arena, John Maher and Zara Hederman are still with me. We're moving to live experiences now. Ticket prices through the roof in a lot of cases, but a recent survey showed that people are more likely to pay big money for a gig than for other luxuries. So good news for promoters and good news for some artists anyway. Who is coming here this year? John, give me a few that you're really looking forward to.
Well, from a festival point of view, Beyond the Pale looks really good. Glendalough Estate in June features Caribou, Father John, Misty, Soul Wax, All Together Now, which I suppose for particularly an older crowd is probably what Electric Picnic was, the ubiquitous kneecapper there. They're among the first headliners. Loads more names will be announced. Croke Park, The Weeknd, I mean, I think he's going to be brilliant. Two shows in August, but you've got so much in terms of kind of particularly city festivals, the Trinity Series, the Ivy Gardens, wider than pictures of Collins Barracks is consistently excellent. We can't forget about the Live at the Marquee in Cork as well. Just one or two gigs. Kraftwerk, Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, May 17. I mean,
that's going to be a strange one. Kraftwerk in the seated confines.
Yeah, they'll be standing, we'll be sitting.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the all-time great shows I saw was Kraftwerk playing at the Royal Hospital Dublin about 20 odd years ago. It was unbelievable. I have to throw out Paul Simon as well. My God, 84 years old. This year marks the 70th year since he wrote his first song. I mean, come on, if you haven't been to see Paul Simon, go to see Paul Simon. I feel like I've spoken a lot. Zara, do you want to add something?
You have lots to talk about as well, Zara. Where do you want to start? Go for it.
So one that I'll start with is David Byrne is coming in March. He's doing the Who is the Sky tour. That was his most recent album. That's off the back of him doing as well the American Utopia shows, which were hugely successful, massive productions. Here he says this show blends visual art, storytelling and music, and if you haven't listened to that album, don't worry, I've looked at the set list. He is still doing Once in a Lifetime, Psycho Killer and This Must Be the Place. So if you're a Talking Heads fan,
I think as far as I know it is sold out as well in three
it
arenas.
It is, unfortunately. Maybe a resale in a legitimate way. Belle and Sebastian anniversary tours are going to be in the Three Olympia. They're doing Tiger Milk and If You're Feeling Sinister. Both albums turn 30 this year, so I have my ticket for If You're Feeling Sinister because I love that album. The Stars of Track and Field, You Are, one of my favourite songs. They're also an amazing live band. They're great fun, so one to watch. And then Cass McCombs is coming in February. So I think the three of us reviewed his album in the summertime. Just an amazing songwriter, getting better and better. And he's bringing that Interior Live Oak album to the Workman's, I believe, with a full band.
Yeah, just remind us who Cass McCombs is again, because it's an interesting location as well. The Workman's, obviously, it's a nice tight space.
Yeah, like that album. So he's a New York based artist. He's a singer-songwriter, has kind of built up like a folk rock sensibility, but each album kind of gets bigger and bigger. And with this one, it was a double album. He perfected his songwriting. He's creating all these incredible stories, and within that, a really great Americana kind of songbook to go with it. So a small venue, I think, would work really well because that gig will demand attention, I think.
Okay, let's play some Cass McCombs. Just to remind you, this is Priestess. That's Cass McCombs and that's Priestess. John, is there anything else that we might need to keep an eye out for in terms of gigs?
Yeah, Lily Allen. I mean, so many people talked about West End Girl last year, like an album that dissected the end of her marriage to David Harbour. Extraordinary album. She plays the Three Arena in Dublin on June 30. And
that's quite an extraordinary thing insofar as if Lily Allen would not have been playing the Three Arena 12 months ago or 18 months ago.
Definitely not.
But because what this album has done, it is now opening up those kind of gigs.
Absolutely. Like it was a viral sensation as much as anything else because people were just nosy about what she was. I mean, she let it all out there. It's an extraordinary album. For anybody who hasn't heard it, listen to it. Also, Kings of Leon, they're playing Thomond Park, usually home for Munster Rugby, but they're July 1. They're a cracking live band. I mean, it's just so good. No matter what you think of Kings of Leon, if you want to see a rock band giving it all, go to that.
Okay, Zara, music documentaries to watch out for this year? You've decided to pick a few of those first. Where do you want to start?
So I'll start maybe with Broken English, the Marianne Faith one, given her anniversary is coming up at the end of the month. So Ian Forsythe and Jane Pollard, who made 20,000 Days on Earth, they have made this. And it's an interesting concept. It's kind of like an auto-fiction film where they've created this like world within the film called the Ministry of Not Forgetting, which features Tilda Swinton and George Mackey. So they'll be kind of reenacting like her songs, her life. But then also we get like interviews with Marianne Faithfull. She features in the documentary before she passed. Nick Cave, Warren Ellis. There's also performances from Courtney Love and Suki Waterhouse. So that'll be an interesting one to kind of go over the breadth of her amazing career, 35 albums. And often she's very much diminished as just Mick Jagger's partner when she was so much more and had such an incredible career. Like one of her albums I was listening to a lot last year was A Secret Life, which she made with Angelo Badalamenti, and it's remarkable. So I'm very excited about that. That's coming March.
And that sounds less like a standard documentary and more like something that gives you something completely different.
Yeah, something kind of, it reminds me a bit of like what Edgar Wright did with the Sparks Brothers, kind of melding different textures with the film to kind of give more depth to her story, which is very much deserved. I mentioned Courtney Love is going to feature in that. She's also getting her own documentary called Anti-Heroine. So that is coming from a team of Edward Lovelace and James Hall, who made The Possibilities Are Endless, which is a documentary about Edwin Collins. So this, I think people are going to be really excited about it because we've been waiting for a memoir from her for about 10 years. So this is going to fill the hole, if you'll permit the pun.
Ooh, I'll just allow it.
Thank you. So she features in this. She's talking about new music. She actually mentions the memoir in this. And then she's talking about her sobriety, but also her career as a musician in Hole, the aforementioned, her solo career, but also her acting career, which we kind of can't forget about. And she had great accolades in that as well. So that's one that's coming out.
Okay, and you've got one more for us?
And then
Charlie XX?
The final one, yeah. It's a kind of mockumentary called The Moment. It's coming out at the end of the month and she plays a fictionalized version of herself post-Brat. She's going on a headline tour and she's kind of struggling with the whole fame of it all. What's going to come next? What's expected of her? Incredible cast in this. So we've got Rosanna Arquette, Alexander Skarsgård, Kate Berland, Rachel Sennett and Kylie Jenner making her theatrical screen debut.
As you do. Just before we finish, I realise we forgot to mention Sleaford Mods, John, and I want to make sure that they get some sort of token mention in amongst all of this.
Yes, next, this day week, their latest album, The Demise of Planet X, is out. The second single, The Good Life, really cracking single, but also I was fascinated by the video because Ben Wheatley, one of the great UK directors of his generation, is behind it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Thank you both very much for coming on tonight. John Marzara, Hederman, thanks a million for doing that. I want to remind you about Monday Night's Arena because on Monday, star Brendan Fraser and director Hikari are both going to be talking to me about the new Japanese movie Rental Family. I will have in studio folk legend Peggy Seeger, who's going to be talking to me about 70 years of singing and touring and her activism as well. And we'll be talking to director Conor Hanratty on the Dido and Aeneas event that's happening at this year's Classics Now Festival. Have a brilliant weekend. Sheila O'Callaghan produced the show tonight. It's been researched by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton is our broadcast coordinator and Paul Murnock was on sound supervision. I'm Rick O'Shea. I'll talk to you Monday from 7 o'clock and Fíochna O'Brien on is after the news.